The Daily Rios, episode 486, Alex Ross's Marvel Timeless Mural, a breakdown, part 5. Hey everyone, this is your host, Peter. Here it is, part 5, the final part of the breakdown series on the Marvel Timeless Mural created by artist Alex Ross. This is clearly the most I've talked about Marvel comics in a long time. This final part covers the last bunch of characters on the mural: Shang-Chi, Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Girl, Human Torch, Silver Surfer, She-Hulk, Namor the Submariner, and Ghost Rider. Now, I can tell you up front, I'm going to be fairly sparse this episode when it comes to the stories surrounding a bunch of these characters. I am not well read when it comes to Namor or Ghost Rider, She-Hulk to a degree. So my recommendations or those stories that come to mind immediately for some of these characters, it's not going to be a long list. So I do have a larger thought, though, about all of these characters, and I'm going to start off with that. So if you go back to part one of this series, I talked about how Alex Ross's original lineup for this design was only about 25 characters or so, and then the image was expanded to the right and to the left, and then we got up to 35 characters. So the characters that I'm talking about today in this episode are all from our left side of the expansion, and it's fun to see how many of those characters all connect to the larger Fantastic Four universe, right? Because you have the obvious ones. You got Reed, Sue, and Johnny. The Thing was already on the main image, so he basically was going to represent the Fantastic Four if the other three hadn't ever shown up, right? But then also in this expansion, you have Namor the Submariner, who first appeared in the Silver Age Marvel Universe in Fantastic Four number 4. You have Silver Surfer, who also made his first appearance within the Fantastic Four title. And then you have two characters who were alternate members of the team, with She-Hulk and, yes, even Ghost Rider, for a short stint anyway. So, just like how on the opposite side, when Alex Ross expanded on the right-hand side, you got more members of the X-Men universe, but then you also got a few more Avengers characters and some other characters. On this side, it feels like it's like the whole Fantastic Four corner of the Marvel universe is being represented, which makes a lot of sense. Maybe not so much in the idea of these characters existing in the late 70s, but if you think about the whole creation of the Marvel universe, you have to include members of the Fantastic Four. So I kind of like that. I dig that. All right, let's go individually here, starting with their individual designs and then those stories that come to mind. So we start with Shang-Chi. So design-wise, Shang-Chi first appeared in Special Marvel Edition 15 from 1973 as created by Steve Englehart and Jim Starlin, which I didn't know. Starlin would work on the character for only about 3 issues before he wanted to bail because he felt embarrassed by how the stories were being presented, and he felt the Fu Manchu character was not a character that they should be playing with, and felt that it was a character that was a throwback to a time when you know, villains were usually ethnic, and the way they were portrayed like stereotypes. So he wanted off the book. Now, in the Alex Ross image, the character's initial design is there. It's more or less reflected. You got the headband, you got the red pants with the yellow pattern at the cuffs. He's barefoot. There is no tunic, however, and Ross doesn't give him those black wristbands that the character has worn off and on. Now, if we go through the history of Shang-Chi comics and the design of the character, which really was a pain to do initially because there are so many articles about his upcoming movie, so it's like I can't get beyond that, which was kind of frustrating. Anyway, so we had Jim Starlin with the creation of the character, and then we moved to Paul Gulacy, who pretty much made a name for himself on the title and who would elevate the title artistically. So I feel like facially, with what Alex Ross is doing design-wise with the character's look, it feels like it's going towards the Paul Gulacy look. And Gulacy freely admits that eventually he started to model the character after Bruce Lee, which makes sense, right? This is all during the 70s and the height of a lot of the kung fu movies and TV shows. So I kind of see that in the Alex Ross design, maybe. I put the two pictures next to each other, Bruce Lee and the Alex Ross Shang-Chi, and yeah, you know, I sort of see a little bit of a similarity. So having him not in the tunic, I don't think the tunic is necessarily traditional, because throughout some of the images that I've seen, you see him wearing the tunic. A lot of times you see him not wearing the tunic. In fact, he wasn't wearing the tunic way back in Master of Kung Fu number 19, which is only like the character's, fourth, fifth appearance. It was a cover by Gil Kane, and he's bare-chested. He's bare-chested on the cover. So, and that's because in the story, he was also bare-chested as he went up against the Man-Thing. So it's not like, I don't know. I don't know if the tunic is traditional or not, but I suppose Alex Ross just wanted him bare-chested, maybe because there's so much going on in this image. That way you don't get to see all the crazy designs and you don't have to draw like a tunic, you know? And again, if we're going with the era of late 70s, by that time in the comics, in Shang-Chi comics, he kind of was always going around bare-chested. Speaking of the late 70s with Shang-Chi, by that time, Mike Zeck was on a pretty long run. So again, is Ross channeling Gulacy? Is he channeling Mike Zeck? Is he channeling himself? I'm not sure, but it feels like it could be a mixture of all of that. Now, story-wise, this is another character, just like Jessica Drew's Spider-Woman, that by the time I was reading Marvel Comics in the early 80s, he was inactive, more or less. I had a few comics from the 70s in the stack that my uncle gave me from a farmer's market, which basically kicked off my love of comics, but I don't remember reading them. I remember paging through them, and these were late-era Paul Gulacy drawn books, so I don't have them anymore. I know the character had a number of appearances in Marvel Comics Presents, the anthology title. Again, I probably read them, don't really remember them. And outside of that, I don't have any stories that immediately come to mind. So I'm going to go to the listeners and say, okay, what are the Shang-Chi comics that come to mind? They don't have to be the best. They just have to be ones that speak to you when you hear about the character. All right, let's go to Mr. Fantastic, Invisible Girl, and Human Torch. And yes, I said Invisible Girl, because if we're going with the late 70s, she had not turned into Invisible Woman just yet. All right, design-wise, the Human Torch's design is fairly consistent to the way Alex Ross likes to interpret the character on covers and prints. It's definitely closer to Jack Kirby's original design of the character from the first two issues of Fantastic Four, where it just looked like a human-sized flame was flying around, rather than the later version, where you can clearly see the outline of a body, and then the flames are more like an aura around that image. And that would be from Fantastic Four issue number 3. This more traditional, that's the more traditional Human Torch look, right? And it also has all those little lines scratched onto his body. So when you see the character as interpreted by Alex Ross, where it looks like a flame come to life, that really feels like it's a holdover from when Alex Ross drew the Marvel's Painted miniseries in the early 90s. Where he was designing the original android Human Torch, and it, again, looked just like a man on fire as opposed to some kind of like fiery humanoid. Now for Reed and Sue, for me, it is all about the hairstyles here. So if you look to the 70s Fantastic Four comics, once we're beyond Jack Kirby, right? I'm talking about John Buscema, Rich Buckler, George Perez. When you look at those comics, as I started to do my research, I saw this pattern of how Alex Ross is drawing Reed Richards and Sue Storm. So I hit a random Fantastic Four issue. It was around the 160s. And I noticed that they had the title logo, and surrounding the title logo were four circlets, and each one had a headshot of each member of the Fantastic Four. So I'm not talking about the corner box. I'm talking about the actual logo itself, the title logo, and they had these four circlets, two on each side. And it's a design that carried, as I discovered in my research, it went from issue 160 all the way to 217. So this is 1975 to 1980. And that little four-character circlet design also showed up when Jonathan Hickman did his run on Fantastic Four. So looking at Reed and Sue in those circles, the hairstyles that they have, for the most part, are completely similar to what Alex Ross is doing. So you have Reed, and he has one little curl on one side of his hairline, and the way Sue's hair is shoulder length, but it feels poofy, and there's a part on one side. It's a little bit Kirby, but it's also 70s. Those hairstyles, super reflected in all of those cover designs. I don't know who did those little circlets. I don't know if it's John Buscema or a holdover from later Kirby. But it feels super, super similar. Even if the interiors are different from what Alex Ross is doing, because I know, like, I think it's Perez. He gave Reed at times two different little curls, one on each side, but there's clearly only one here. And with Sue, in some of the later 70s covers, her hair gets long and straight. It goes past her shoulders. So it's not that kind of, like, for lack of a better term, housewifey kind of look. So if we're trying to capture that 70s flair, that's what I think he's going for. And I think that's kind of cool. I think it's kind of cool that he might be inspired by those little circlets rather than, you know, what's going on the inside. A lot of those facial features, especially with Reed, held over to various different artists. I mean, even Byrne would have that same sort of high hairline and that one little curl, except Byrne would eventually make Reed's face look a little thinner. And the way he drew Sue was completely different. So the other thing about the design is the number four on the chest is black in the Alex Ross design. And a lot of the images that I'm seeing and that I'm remembering, the four was blue. So I don't know if that's a design choice, if there ever really was a time when the four was black and not blue. I'm talking pre-1980, pre-Byrne taking them to the negative zone and their costumes inverting. When they were just in kind of like variations of the Kirby design, most of the times it's blue. So I'm not sure what he's trying to evoke there, but I just wanted to make note of that. Story-wise, okay, for me, I've read a lot of Fantastic Four. It's less about individual stories. There are great individual stories, obviously, but for me, what comes to mind is runs, long runs on these characters, runs that are made up of all of the great stories that we might remember. You know, I read the Byrne run. I think that's important. If you're a Fantastic Four fan, you need to read the Byrne run. I also really like the Mark Waid, Mike Waringo run from the early 2000s when they were called the Imaginauts, you know. I'm particularly fond of Carlos Pacheco's run as a writer on Volume 3 of Fantastic Four. This is when they came back from the Heroes Reborn universe around issues 30, the mid-30s to the mid-50s. For some reason, I don't know why, I just have a fondness for that. Some of those issues were drawn by Pacheco as well. Great just a great read. It's not very long, but there's some interesting things in it. And yeah, I had a good time with that. Of course, Jonathan Hickman's run, especially, I really like the FF series, especially the volume by Fraction, Matt Fraction, and the All Reds. It was so good. It was such a interesting look at the larger Marvel Universe and some of the oddities of the Marvel Universe. Yeah, I just think as a concept, as the founding family of the Marvel Universe, if you're going to read about them, you're reading runs. At least that's my experience anyway. And really, those runs probably cater to your particular wants when it comes to what you want to get out of a comic or what you want to get out of this team. You know, do you want something that's sci-fi? Do you want something that's more Kirby-like? Do you want something that's more grand and has to deal with the larger Marvel Universe, you know? I've read a very small fraction of the Stan Lee Jack Kirby run, but it's something I've always wanted to do because that is the, you know, more or less the foundation of the Marvel Universe, you know? So, yeah, that's where my head goes when I think about the Fantastic Four. All right, Silver Surfer. Again, I have to go back to the way Ross drew the character during his Marvel's miniseries with Kurt Busiek, because he's not doing the standard, here's the Silver Surfer, but he's colored white, you know? He's going straight silver, reflective, shiny, almost like a mirror, you know? And I have to imagine from an artist's point of view how much fun that could be, but how much of a challenge it is too, because not only are you drawing the character and the anatomy, but you're also drawing the reflection of what's around that character, and you have highlights and you have shadows. It's really just, it's really great. I mean, when you really kind of study it, it's fairly innovative the way he draws that character. So for me, yeah, pure Alex Ross when it comes to what I'm seeing here. Story-wise, I've read Silver Surfer in comics like Fantastic Four, stuff with Thanos, Infinity Gauntlet, guest appearances, even small bits of his own series from the late 80s. But the story that stands out the most for me, not necessarily because it's the best, but just because of my enjoyment factor, probably, it has to be his turn in the original Annihilation event in the mid-2000s. And, you know, all of Marvel's cosmic characters got a revamp at that time. And Silver Surfer was no different. I think he went back to being a Herald of Galactus at the time. And I think what I like the most about it, not necessarily just about Silver Surfer, but about all of Marvel Cosmic, is because they were moving away from the philosophical angle that Jim Starlin always seemed to put the characters in, you know? That was kind of gone, and it was just Marvel Cosmic for Marvel Cosmic's sake. And they found new ways to play with it. And that's what I just felt like a breath of fresh air. Now, eventually, Starlin would come back to Thanos, and then we would get the whole Infinity Gems again. But for me, that's a high point for me when it comes to Silver Surfer and other characters. I haven't read a lot of the characters' standalone stories, like the one drawn by Mobius. I'm sure that's high on people's lists. And there's some other Stan Lee stories that, you know, when you think about Silver Surfer, you go to them. I did read the Galactus trilogy, so I guess I should probably put that on the list. But yeah, I'm a little empty when it comes to this character as well. We move to She-Hulk. So I talked about her design in part one of this series because she's not sporting her Savage She-Hulk look from her first appearance, which is right in the beginning of 1980, because that's where I feel like that's the latest that Alex Ross has designed any of these characters, right? When you look at all these characters, as I explained in that first part, She-Hulk was created in 1980, and there are no other characters after that. Right, so you don't get like Rogue, and you don't get Gambit, and you don't get you know, Bishop, or you know, whoever else was Venom, you know, things like that. So you would think she would be in her Savage She-Hulk look, but she's not. She's in a look that came from Avengers starting around 278 in the mid-80s, where she's wearing that purple leotard. And this was shortly after she was a member of the Fantastic Four. And she had worn a leotard before, but it wasn't that color, I don't think. So I guess he probably just felt, look, she's been a regular superhero longer than she's been a savage She-Hulk. So if we're talking timeless, let's put her in a costume. And I can understand that. Also, you have to look at the way she's standing there and her face. I mean, she's totally in control. She's confident. She's got those bangs hanging down from her forehead, just like the way John Buscema created her with. If you go back to the Savage She-Hulk title from the 80s, and you look at her corner box, you can kind of see the same little tuft of hair. Story-wise, I think I read Savage She-Hulk number one in that stack of books that my uncle gave me. But I think my real first exposure was Secret Wars, the first maxi series. I obviously read her time in the Fantastic Four. In fact, in many ways, I think of the Fantastic Four with She-Hulk because of that. And I also really liked the 2004 and 2005 She-Hulk series written by Dan Slott, especially when the stories were drawn by Juan Bobillo. There was just something very fun and whimsical, and I thought he captured the character really well. So I do enjoy those volumes. I have not read the Byrne version or many of the, you know, Savage She-Hulk. So I don't have, I think I might have read her graphic novel. I don't remember. But again, if I'm talking about stories that immediately popped to mind, that little short list is what I have. Okay, Namor. Namor the Submariner. He's clearly got his Bill Everett severe eyebrows and hairline here, as well as the elf ears. But Alex Ross has him drawn with wristbands. And I think, if my research is right, that really didn't, those that little design element didn't come into play until the late 60s, during the last year of Tales to Astonish. He was flipping back and forth with the Hulk in that anthology. So Bill Everett had returned to the book after, you know, so many years, and I believe that's when the wristbands came into play. When you look at his number one issue from 1968, you can see the wristbands right on the cover. So by the time the late 70s had rolled around, Namor was showing up in Supervillain Team-Up, a series also featuring Dr. Doom, but he didn't have many appearances after that for a little while. So story-wise, I have to go to the four-issue Prince Namor the Submariner miniseries from the early 80s by J.M. DeMatteis and Bob Budiansky. I was a fan of all of those Marvel miniseries, so that was one that I remember collecting. Obviously, the way they use Namor in the Illuminati concept is fun and interesting, and a smart use of his character. Beyond that, here we go again. Not a lot of reading experience. And if I do read the character, I don't know, maybe some of those stories just aren't definitive, so let me know what you think. I mean, I've always wanted to check out the Byrne run that began in 1990. Maybe I should read some Invaders comics, I don't know. I don't know what stories stand out outside of his, like, major Fantastic Four appearances. So, yeah, you know, feed me your suggestions. And finally, we have Ghost Rider. Design-wise, if this is Johnny Blaze, we're talking Marvel Spotlight number 5 from 1972 by Roy Thomas, Gary Friedrich, and Mike Ploog. Lots of controversy over who did what when it came to designing the character, but you have the flaming skull, and you have his jacket, his pants, his boots, his gloves, his motorcycle, obviously. Apparently, the front panel of his costume was modeled after the Western Ghost Rider's costume, and Mike Ploog said that the stripes were designed so that the character would, so that there would be some break in the character's body, because the jacket was all black or dark, He says, the stripes down the arms and the legs were there merely so I could make the character's costume as black as I possibly could and still keep track of his body. It was the easiest way to design him. That makes sense. The way Alex Ross designs those stripes, they almost look reflective, which kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, if you think of that material that runners wear at night, and if you think of the Ghost Rider character's history with, I don't want to say circus, but, you know, like Evel Knievel type events, it would make sense that maybe his costume would be a little flashy, right? By the late 70s, Don Perlin was drawing the Ghost Rider title. When you look at the image, you can just make out that the cycle that he's on looks like it has a windshield design that looks like a skull. You know, if you think of Captain America, the one of those 90s movies where he, or is it 70s? 70s, yeah, I forget when that movie came out. Where he has a motorcycle and the windshield is made up of his actual shield. So the Ghost Rider used to ride around in a motorcycle that had a big skull face, right? And apparently that's from Ghost Rider number 11 from 1975. It is not his original Hell Cycle. It is called the Skull Cycle. And I guess it didn't have the same properties. It didn't have the magical properties that the Hell Cycle has. But you can just make it out on the Alex Ross image that he's using that skull look. So that's kind of cool. Story-wise, again, not to be anticlimactic, but I got nothing. I got nothing. I have the X-Men crossover between the two in the early 90s. I've always wanted to read the Midnight Sun stuff because it was so heavily promoted at that time. I just don't have anything that comes to mind. It's another character that in the 80s was defunct for a long time. There was no Johnny Blaze Ghost Rider. The next time Ghost Rider would come out, it would be Danny Ketch, right? So yeah, I have nothing. It's not a character that even speaks to me, right? I guess the new version showed up in the, Jason Aaron Avengers? So I might have read a few of those appearances, but yeah, I'm not a big Ghost Rider reader. So that's it. That's where it all ends. That's where all my recommendations end. And that is it for the breakdown series on the Marvel Timeless Mural. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope it maybe kicked off some impulses to maybe go read some stuff or to think about these characters in your own reading experience, which is really ultimately the point. So send me an email, Peter at the Daily Rios, or leave a comment on the website, thedailyrios.com. Let me know what you think about these characters that I have very little experience with. Okay, so the next episode in the Daily Rios feed will be the Legion Project episode 24. This episode was recorded back in July, I wasn't able to edit it because my laptop had crashed a few days or like a week after we recorded it. So Eric had to do the big push on this, which was great. So the Legion Project will be released next after this episode. And then I will also be doing the next Daily Rios episode on the laptop fundraiser because we have hit 50% as of today. Thank you, Matt W. So yeah, I have hit 50%. That is awesome. So I'm going to do an episode just thanking everybody so far. And again, as I've written in some of the emails to people, you know, this has been a really big boost. I want to do more content because of this. And people have been giving me suggestions, which is awesome. So just so honored that we've reached 50%, and hopefully we can get the rest of the way. All right, this has been the Daily Rios episode 486 for Wednesday, August 19th. Talk to you soon.